Welcome to Confessions of a COO. My name is Carl Swansbury, and I'm delighted today to have Joanna Kingston Davies, COO and co-founder of Mapped Group, on my podcast. Joanna is not only a friend of mine, but also a client, and she is currently running a national legal services business as COO. Mapped Group has gone through a significant amount of growth and change over the last 3 years, having made multiple acquisitions on the back of having gone through an MBO back in 2020 in a debt-funded management buyout transaction, again led by Joanna. She's an inspiring business leader. She's incredibly empathetic and focuses in on the people part of business. And for sure, I think today we're in for a real treat. Joanna, first of all, I just want to thank you for joining me today on my podcast. Obviously, as a close friend and as a client of mine, we spend a lot of time in each other's company, but actually never in a setting like this. So massive thanks, Joanna, for agreeing to join me on the podcast today.
Thank you for having me.
Before we sort of perhaps talk a little bit about your professional career, I'd like to go right back to where it started, if that's okay. Can you just tell me a little bit about, I guess, your education and upbringing?
Wow. Okay. Yeah, sure. So I'm one of four girls. My father was an accountant by background and my mother is a scientist. So we grew up in the countryside, very privileged in the middle of a field. I loved languages and music at school. Was very passionate about all the music that I did. Went on holiday yearly to France and ended up reading French and music at uni, which was largely what I loved rather than what I intended to be, I guess.
And how did you find yourself in France? What was the sort of...
So I just always had this innate love of France and languages, I guess. And as I say, I went to uni to read French and music. Initially, I actually went to read music, because I was terrified of the year abroad, which was quite ironic seeing as I then spent 7 years living over there. And I suppose when I was at uni, I got to the point where I thought, I love French. This is crazy. I need to just get over myself and actually face into it. So did my year abroad. At that point, I wanted to go into teaching and I was a language assistant in a school, which put me off teaching for life. And but I absolutely loved being in France. I found the last year at uni really tough, actually, being back in the UK. So the second I graduated, I quite literally took my suitcase and got on a plane and landed up on the Champs-Élysées to look for a job.
For someone who was from a big family, family first, a bit of a home, but I mean, that must have been something that you did in a really excited, albeit anxious way, because I guess you weren't someone who traveled extensively prior to university.
Family holidays, I guess, and we traveled sort of quite far and wide. But I think, my parents always wanted me to thrive, and my dad really, when I started talking about going back to France, they really supported me. And you know, it's fairly close, isn't it? So I think they all benefited too from the weekends away, particularly when there were rugby matches on. So,
what was sort of the one thing that you thought you would be able to get out of spending more time in France? I mean, I appreciate that being made, but what was the sort of one thing that really did encourage you to sort of pack up and, you know, put yourself out of your comfort zone to some degree?
I think it just felt different, felt interesting, felt that it would broaden my horizons. And I think I just had this innate curiosity about different cultures, and albeit France is very close, but, you know, just seeing the world and moving out of my comfort zone. And it just felt like the most natural thing in the world in some ways.
I mean, that's fascinating, isn't it? So the most natural thing, albeit probably at the same time feeling anxious in doing it.
Yeah, I guess when I did my year abroad at uni, I just felt so at home. I was in Tours in the Loire Valley for my year abroad, but I just felt so utterly at home there that it felt like home. So going back didn't feel like a big thing at all, really. I think a bigger thing in some ways would have been moving to London or Manchester.
Yes.
Going to Paris just felt like home.
Awesome. So, and what a beautiful place to call home.
Absolutely.
So obviously, whilst in France, that's when you found yourself entering the legal services sector for the first time. Could you tell me a bit about how that opportunity came about, Joanna?
Sure. So when I landed back up in Paris, the legal markets at the time were really buoyant. It was 99. Sort of the M&A markets were incredibly buoyant. And I was bilingual and I could touch type. So the obvious thing to do was to find a job as a bilingual legal secretary in the international law firms. And I did the round, sort of got six job offers. And the one I loved the most was what was then Lovell White Durrant, now Hogan Lovells. There was a really nice feel about it. So I took a job there as a bilingual legal secretary. And that's how I fell into the legal sector, purely by accident, I guess. But loved it and found it really interesting. I was working for an employment partner, some really, really interesting clients, multinational clients. And after a couple of months, I just wanted to do a little bit more. So I went to see the FD and said, what can I do? And she said, what do you want to do? And I said, people. And she said, that's brilliant. We're about to monumentally grow. So HR it is. So after a few months, I ended up as the HR function.
Wow. And something you said there, I'd love to just explore a bit further, was that you had a number of offers at that time from great law firms.
Yeah.
And the offer you decided to accept largely was as a consequence of the great culture and the great vibe that the firm had.
Yep.
Just talk to me about that specifically, because actually what fascinates me about that is that I'm sure some of the other firms were probably as successful, perhaps international, perhaps larger.
Yep.
But actually what attracted you wasn't those things, but in fact the vibe and the culture.
100%. And actually, many of them were larger than what's now Hogan Lovells, and also offered more money. But for me, it's just a gut feel. It's about how you feel, which is very much what we've translated into MAPT, that how you make people feel. And that's how I felt when I walked in and thought, I feel at home here. And I think that's just something that you can't necessarily articulate or put into words. It's that feeling of this feels right. And it was the right one to take.
In the interview you had then, and of course I'm encouraging you to think back some years, Joanna.
Yeah, indeed.
I will forgive you if your memory
not saying my age.
But how did the interviewer make you feel at home? Bearing in mind, of course, the interviewer is there to work out whether they want to hire you.
Yeah.
So actually, there is almost a bit of a conflict of interest there in that, you know, the person interviewing you wants you to feel at home, but they also want to hold you to account and want to give you a grilling. Just talk me through that.
I think, from memory, all of those interviews through the six or so that I did were very similar. They all did a typing test and a language test and the standard stuff you'd expect.
Mm.
And then there was a conversation. And I think the conversation, I don't remember it incredibly well. I remember seeing the FD, who was responsible for recruitment at the time. I remember thinking, probably subconsciously with hindsight, but that a female FD was really a good thing.
Yes.
And the partner who I ultimately worked with, and he actually, you know, stayed with the business for a long time, and I'm still in touch with him, who I first worked for, was just really lovely. And I think he talked about his children and...
Really?
It was just a nicer conversation. So, yeah.
Interesting. It's fascinating, isn't it? Because I think when businesses are looking to recruit, often they'll put the wrong person in front of the candidate or the right person, but with the wrong approach.
Absolutely. We're huge at that now.
Ultimately was important to you at that time in your career when making that first step.
Yeah, and now you say it, actually, it probably informs very much, as I say, subconsciously, but the way we think about things now in terms of the way we approach recruitment and retention, and it is that feeling. It's absolutely about how you make people feel.
So tell me, so obviously you joined this law firm. Very quickly, it became apparent that maybe your ambition was bigger than the role that you had joined to fulfill. And of course, you found yourself very quickly being responsible for all things people. How did that role evolve for you? Bear in mind, you're not and weren't then, you know, a HR professional.
No. So very quickly is the answer in terms of how it evolved.
Yes.
I remember initially helping out with payroll and having Excel spreadsheets, which probably made me hate numbers and realize that numbers wasn't necessarily my forte, nor is Excel, but navigated my way through that, quickly started recruiting, and we went through a period of very rapid organic growth there. So we grew from a headcount of sort of 45 people when I joined to 150 in the first year of me being in that function. So in terms of policy, processes, liaising with London to get those into place, recruiting, growing, office moves, everything happened very, very quickly. And then from an inorganic perspective, we acquired a French boutique corporate commercial firm, and I was heavily involved in that. Very unfortunately, really, that we sort of completed just after 9/11, and obviously the corporate markets crashed. From an HR perspective, it was hugely interesting in terms of the dynamic and redeployments and everything that was happening. And it was just a really big phase for growth for the Paris office of what was Lovell White Durrant, then Lovell's. And yeah, as I say, we had a management team that was very cohesive, and I learned an incredible amount from the managing partner about the way he went about things. So I never formally trained in HR, but just learned on the hoof as I was going along. And I think, you know, any HR or people function is, it's about that instinct, isn't it? It's about kindness. It's about a human approach to things. So whilst there is employment law that underpins contractual elements of a role, technical skills can always be taught and learnt. Bit about what you give of yourself to that role and the compassion that you can show to people is the fundamental for me. So that carries way more importance than the technical sort of parts of the role, if you like.
I mean, obviously, I've known you for a long time, but many of our viewers haven't had the pleasure, Joanna, of meeting you. Yeah. So I'd like to ask a question more so for the benefit of the viewers. Where does your compassionate side come from? Because as a very successful businesswoman, perhaps compassion might not be a trait that people would assume is required. So just talk to me about where your compassion, your sort of real respect for people stems from.
Good question. I suppose I'm the eldest of four girls. I was always very, to the extent that I was seven and had three younger siblings, I was probably always fairly nurturing and helped my mum out. You know, when we were out in the swimming pool, I took care of the two-year-old and she took the five-year-old and the baby. And, you just grow up in a certain way. And I think, you know, we're a very close family unit as well. And my dad ran a business. My parents always nurtured that in us, I think. Always be kind, always be respectful. And I suppose it's just always the way I've been. They always used to laugh at me and say I was super sensitive when I was younger, and still am, I guess. And that always used to be seen as a weakness, I suppose. Sort of rewind 20 years in a business setting, which now isn't at all, and actually is really fundamental to doing business ethically and sustainably in the right way. So yeah, I think it was just something that was innate in us as children. And I saw parents who cared about the world, who cared about society, and they just instilled that in us, I suppose.
It's interesting you just said there that perhaps now, more than ever before, being vulnerable is actually perhaps a positive trait.
Yeah.
Whereas I think, you know, only 10 years ago, Joanna, I think if you were a business leader, you had to give the impression that you were stern, focused, no-nonsense, cutthroat. I think vulnerability perhaps 10 years ago would have been a weakness or something perceived as a sense. Why do you think over such a short period of time that has changed so materially?
Yeah, I think sort of kindness generally in leadership, people have started to see the positives. And I think rewind 15, 20 years, there was very much an ethos, I don't want to generalize, but sort of the world of business tended to be sort of suits, jacket on the back of a chair, work hard. Yeah. I think you tended to find that women in business had to become quite hard to compete in what was a more male-dominated world. And I think people have seen, I mean, we find it now fundamental to our business. I think the more you show vulnerability, and through some of the experiences I've had over the last 10 years, I think when you see, if you give that bit of yourself and you see people react very positively, and people be just fundamentally reassured that actually, if you're a leader in an organization, that actually you face the same challenges, that you're not different, that you might look like a swan on the surface, but you're frantically paddling underneath, and that you have the same challenges as everybody else does, because we're all human and it's no different, regardless of whether you're, you know, 50, 60, 25, regardless of your life experience, the same challenges are there in terms of life. So I think just people respond very positively to that. And I think probably business leaders over the last 10 years or so have seen that positive response and realized that it's necessary, and the world is changing and people's requirements are different. So it's just evolution, isn't it, I suppose, but in a very positive way.
Yeah, it is fascinating, though, to sort of stop and just observe that. Because, yep. Yeah, I do think, certainly now with podcasts like this, I think people are given the chance to perhaps see behind the curtain. Yeah. Whereas, you know, for many years, you know, you only saw the veneer of the person.
Yeah, and I think, do you know what, rewinding, I remember one of my first appraisals when I was in HR at what's now Hogan Lovells, and the managing partner said to me, you know, you need to be less sensitive. And he said that not in a way to, you know, he didn't want to offend me, but in the world I worked in, he needed me to be a little less sensitive. But to a degree, you can't change who you are innately as a person. If you're sensitive, you're sensitive. You can never fundamentally change who you are. I suppose you do harden over with experience and age. You sort of become a little bit more hardened to things. But actually, it took me quite a long time to realize that sensitivity can be really channeled to positive effect. And actually, I didn't need to be less sensitive. I just needed to probably find an environment where that sensitivity can be channeled very positively.
Yes.
But also that it is a strength in leadership, and not to shy away from it, because actually sensitivity is no different to anger or some of the sort of more macho emotions that we might see in business. It's just no different. It's an emotion. And actually, if you care, depending on the organization within which you work or the function that you have within that organization, used to positive effect, it's really, really powerful.
And we'll I don't want to sort of leapfrog too many years.
Yeah.
But just one quick question.
Yeah.
Obviously, as co-founder and COO of a very large national legal services business, you know, there is lots of weight on your shoulder. Would you say that you have become less sensitive?
No.
Since you have had appraisal way back when?
No, 100% no. I think your perspective changes, and you probably develop more knowledge, more experience that therefore gives you a broader perspective on things. Am I less sensitive? No, not really. Do I still get bothered by some of the smaller stuff in terms of what affects people in their lives on a day-to-day basis? Probably yes. I probably cope with it slightly differently, yes. But I wouldn't say the sensitivity in itself has gone anywhere. I just have a different view on it and see it through probably a wider prism, I guess.
Sure. Yeah, well, I think that definitely is something I can relate with, because as you say, you are the same person you were then.
Yeah.
But I suspect now you may respond to certain things differently, but it doesn't mean that you view them differently, does it?
No.
Totally respect that.
No.
So obviously, you know, you had demonstrated over a six-year period that you were able to not only sit in many seats within a business, but of course you were also elevating to a much more senior position, still living life, of course, in France. Talk to me about what came next.
So professionally, I suppose, at Lovells, you know, things, it was insane, loved it. I'd started to think, you know, what comes next for me? Do I go into a more European role, or how do I move forward? And I happened to meet my now husband, Matt, who was a partner at the time at a Liverpool-based law firm. And so we met through a mutual friend who happened to be my housemate, who was a partner at Lovells. And he was on the European Young Bar Association with Matt, and it had been sliding doors for years. We'd missed each other at events. And yeah, he came over for a weekend and we met there. We kept EasyJet in business for a few months. And then we got to the point that I guess I just felt ready for a change. And my family are sort of an hour away from where we live now. And it just felt right. His French wasn't great. So his career wasn't necessarily going to accelerate if he moved over to France. So just all things considered, timing was good for me to look at moving back home.
And obviously meeting your now husband, really, really great to see that that was something that was made possible as a consequence of your career. I mean, do you put that down to fate or luck?
Yeah, I suppose, as I say, we'd missed each other for years, and we tried to work out whether we'd been at the same events at different times, and we probably had. And I think it was just, it was great and it felt easy. And it was one of those things that I suppose, relationship-wise, you'd think that having a sort of across the channel relationship would be quite hard. And it was the easiest thing in the world at the time to fly here, there and everywhere. And we'd sometimes meet in Barcelona because it was on, you know, we didn't have to be one place or the other. And I'm not so sure about the environmental credentials now, but back in the day when EasyJet flights were sort of £15 a pop, it was fairly easy. So it's no different to, you know, it was quicker to get to back to Liverpool than it was to London in some ways. So, yeah.
And obviously, you mentioned that after, you know, that sort of long distance relationship for a number of years, you decided that perhaps that wasn't long-term sustainable.
Yeah.
I mean, was there sort of one thing that fundamentally meant you had to decide whether to come back to the UK or potentially move to France long-term? I mean, what was the catalyst to having made that decision?
I think it just happened. There was never a question of us staying in France, really. It just all felt very easy, and there was never really a question. It just happened. There was no sort of, you know, do we or I do X, Y, or Z. It was just, I'm going to move home. It just felt like the most natural sort of conclusion in the world, I suppose.
Yeah, well, home is home.
So, yeah.
And we all gravitated back at some point, perhaps.
To a degree. And you know what? I mean, I'd never really been to Liverpool. We live on the Wirral, but I'd never really been to Liverpool before. But I'd always been very drawn to Liverpool through pictures I'd seen as a child and things. So yeah, it just, and my paternal grandmother was actually born on the Wirral, and I just remembered her playing Ferry Across the Mersey and talking about the books, the Helen Forrester books, when I was younger.
You still decided to move back to Liverpool.
I did. And, you know, where we live now is less than 3 miles away from where my paternal grandmother was actually born.
Wow.
So, yeah, you know, these things just work out. But, yeah, it didn't feel complicated at all, even, you know, without a job to come back to initially. None of it felt complicated. So,
yeah, and let's just talk about that, because obviously to that point, you know, you were very intentional in everything that you've done.
Yeah.
Because to find yourself in France working for an law firm, just happen. And whilst you talk about things just happening, I think that you evidently seem to improve your odds every time you make a decision. So how did it feel coming back to the UK without a next step in your career?
So I did have a job by the time I came back. I had lined up a job. So I went for the interview at what was Lee's. They'd advertised an HR, I don't think it was even an HR manager, they'd advertised an HR coordinator or something of that ilk. And I hadn't really been for a job interview for years, and it was just down the road from where I was going to be. So I thought, I may as well go along. And 3 hours later, came out of that interview with a completely different job to the one I went in for. And do you know what? It just gave me, at the time, I think, I was keen to stay in the legal sector, because I saw lots of opportunity. But what I didn't want to do was go into a big law firm, because in the UK, sort of, this was in 2006, I moved back. Operational functions in, I suppose, in professional services at large, for me, felt very admin-based and paper shuffling and completely disconnected from the business. And what I'd been used to in France was very much working on a daily basis with the managing partner. We were a leadership team.
Yes. Yeah.
And so I didn't want to go back into a sort of operational, reactive, paper shuffling job. So what I saw in Leeds was an opportunity to get way more involved with a broader sort of leadership and management role, wider than HR or people. in a smaller business, but to get sort of to roll up my sleeves and get my hands more dirty, I suppose, and have more influence. And that's exactly what transpired. You know, I went in, it was a relatively small business, 5 million turnover, but that ran very much as an old school law firm with multiple equity partners. You know, each equity partner had an operational role. You had an IT partner, a premises partner, a library partner, and it just needed commercializing and moving forward. And I saw a real opportunity there to get involved in something that was close to home. And it was my mother-in-law who'd seen the advert in the local newspaper, to whom I'll forever be grateful for that. And, you know, it was a really good opportunity. It was a bit of a shock, I'll be honest, when I landed from kind of my Arc de Triomphe view, and suddenly I had a view over barbed wire in a car park in Birkenhead. And it's going to sound ridiculous, but my English was, I wasn't used to business English in a way. And I remember a couple of times phoning my dad quietly and saying, "Dad, does this make sense in English?" Which sounds ridiculous as somebody who is British, but I couldn't remember how to write business English in a way. So there were things that were quite weird, and I would come up with phrases in partners meetings and they'd just laugh, and it was because it was a French word that I'd thrown in there. But I was so sort of entrenched in working in France in French that there were things that were really quite daunting. And I remember my first day walking into the sandwich shop in Birkenhead, and they said to me, I don't know what to ask for, so I said, "Can I have a cheese sandwich, please?" And they said, would you like it on a bin lid or a batch or something?" And I'm thinking, what is a bin lid? And it was a local sort of colloquialism for a huge batch, I guess. And that was actually really traumatic and really daunting. And who knew? The most scary thing about day one would be the sandwich shop, but it was. But yeah, I mean, culturally, and people were talking about spinning and Big Brother and things that I just didn't understand what they were talking about. It was like landing in my own country, being in a foreign country. It was really quite daunting.
Yeah, so back at home, but feeling as a visitor to some degree, yeah. Initially.
What's Big Brother? What's spinning? What's, you know, which I don't know if they're even a thing anymore, but yeah.
And the role that fundamentally you were given, because as you say, it was slightly perhaps more rounded than was advertised. What was the actual role, Joanna, that you accepted?
It was initially business manager.
Business manager.
Yeah.
Talk to me about sort of how that ultimately evolved and climaxed, because of course where you started is very different to where you ended up in that business.
So I guess in a nutshell, as business manager, I just took everything operational from the partners to allow them to focus on client-facing work, productive time, effectively. We quickly moved to an LLP. It was a partnership when I joined, moved to an LLP, brought in a new finance director to, again, commercialize it, move it forward, look at the way the business was structured and financed and everything else, get consistent processes and policies in place, quickly became head of operations and then CEO. When we looked at how we structured the business, the managing partner, when I joined, wanted to step back. We needed to do a review of the structure. I led that review, which was hard because I was wearing sort of two hats, one as a facilitator and not as a business owner at that point. And sort of, you know, as at the time, head of operations of the business, and the restructure that was ultimately collectively agreed was to appoint me as CEO and another one of the partners as managing partner. And we effectively ran that role together, if you like, in the leadership position, sort of co-led the business at the time to move it forward. And then I was invited to become an equity partner. And so I was the first non-lawyer equity partner. And that was in 2010. On the first day of my first maternity leave, which I love in terms of, I guess, how forward-thinking they were back then to make somebody an equity partner, as a lawyer. And, you know, it's interesting how times changed. I remember they invited me to join the equity and I just found out I was in very early stages. I was about 6 weeks pregnant and I wrestled with it, which is awful now because times, again, very fortunately have moved on, but thinking, do I say, do I not say? And I ended up saying to them, look, you should know I'm 6 weeks pregnant. I don't want you to not know this. And obviously way earlier than you would ever tell anybody, but I felt that I should do to the because they'd invited me to be an equity partner. And the managing partner at the time, I just loved his response. And he said, "You've never hidden the fact that you were going to have a family. I'm absolutely overjoyed for you. And a maternity leave is a very short period in a very long career. That's fine." And it was a brilliant response. Mm,
right.
And yeah, as I say, it just happened that I actually joined the equity on the first day of my first maternity leave, which I'm really proud of, again, in terms of how we drive careers for women forward, how we make sure that we create a workplace that respects family, that as much for both parents, it's really important. So, yeah.
And there's two things you've mentioned, which I'd love to just explore a bit further, yep. Joanna. I think the first is being a non-lawyer,
yep.
in a law firm, because yep. most professional services firms, be it legal, accounting, or otherwise, are typically run by qualified professionals. So yep. my firm, ArtG,
yep.
we have 13 partners,
yep.
all qualified accountants,
yep.
Which is good and bad, yep. as you will absolutely yep. know from your experience.
Yep.
Just talk to me about how you think you managed to progress very quickly
yep.
as a non-lawyer in a law firm and become CEO, because that's genuinely just fascinating. And incredibly unusual.
Yeah. So I think it's all about mutual respect. I think if where things don't work is if you get somebody who isn't a lawyer or an accountant coming in and almost laying down the law and saying, "This is what we're going to do," I think there's an awful lot of listening involved. Yeah. I think yeah. you have to innately understand. So if I didn't understand, and this is where the secretarial background I think is very useful as well, you have to fundamentally understand the challenges that face professional lawyer or accountant or whatever it may be on a daily basis. So you have to understand the dynamic of a client file, the technical challenges that come up along the way, the A to Z of a client journey, and the real problems that face a lawyer or an accountant on a day-to-day basis. I think that's crucial. And that's something I would always try and instill in operational teams. Read a file, look at a file, look at the nuance, look at the dynamic as a file progresses, look at the pinch points, look at what's tough, look at what really materially affects the professional client-facing people on a day-to-day basis. Understand that. I think also understanding that you don't necessarily get from A to B by going directly there. Sometimes you have to go off side roads on the way, and that's okay. Yeah, I mean, yeah. Sometimes it takes longer to reach a destination, but actually can be far less painful if you work with it. You've got to bring people with you, haven't you? So if you go in like a bull in a china shop and just try to get from A to B, it will invariably fail. Whereas if you sort of go on a little detour kind of way there, but bring people with you, that's a way more encompassing, holistic, helpful way of getting there. So I think building that trust, building that confidence has its time. But it's also that respect, that understanding, that listening. So yeah, for me, that's what's crucial. And again, that sort of that respect, you know, I think fortunately now we've moved on from the kind of fear and a fee spender mentality, but that's about people understanding who does what and how the two work together. And again, that goes right back to Paris, I suppose, you know, with the managing partner, the relationship we had, I learned a lot from him. I would hope that he learned a lot from me in terms of approach and things, in terms of the way that we worked on things. You know, I learned a lot from him in terms of some of the conversations that he had that were tough on occasions that really shaped me as an individual. And I think, yeah, if you work together in a way that respects what each other does, but you also have a fundamental understanding of different roles and their interplay and the value of people, that's crucial, you know. I will always say that our front of house people, people who answer the phone, the people who see the clients are the most fundamental cogs in you know, the engine of what creates the business, and everybody's equally important. And, you know, you look at different models of leadership, but actually the team coming together and everyone playing their part and understanding what their part is and what other people's part is fundamental. And, you know, again, we do that now at MAPT. We very much communicate what we do, so that people understand it, so it's not so abstract, so that everybody understands the role of everyone else within the team.
Obviously, when you joined the firm,
yeah.
You know, you were an employee,
yeah.
Not elevated. And of course, you know, you ended up, you know, as CEO running the business and as an equity partner. Along the way, there have been lots of hurdles, lots of challenges. What would you say is the one challenge that was most difficult, that did require the most from you?
At Lees, partnership dynamic. I think partnership dynamic in a business of that size, I very much feel that there's sort of, there are different types of partnership or LLP on. There are the ones that are huge, where there's automatically sort of delegated authority, therefore it runs more as a corporate, as a business.
Yeah.
I think very small, tight ownership structures, so sort of up to three partners, is probably quite easy as well, because communication's easy. I think there's probably a 5 to 15 range, which is really tough. Everybody has different aspirations, different, you've got a different age demographic in terms of sort of retirement aspiration. You have different levels of performance, and holding that together at sort of between 5 and 15 partners, I think is really, really tough. Really tough. So undoubtedly, that is the biggest single challenge I had, because you see the business challenges, you look at, you know, again, LLPs are very much built for year-on-year return to equity partners, aren't they, to a degree where you, from a tax perspective and everything else, it's just a different model to a bigger corporate. Therefore, you know, looking at what the business needs and the sustainability of the business and its people for the long term, reconciling that with the aspiration or the requirements of the partners is really challenging. And that's something, again, that we see a lot now at MAPT in terms of what we're trying to do in the businesses we acquire.
So obviously at CEO level within the Lees business, on maternity leave as a new equity partner, you know, what did you envisage would come next? Because of course I know what came next.
Yeah.
What were you envisaging was to come next?
I think it was, two things were clear. One was that, as I've just alluded to, the sort of partnership structure couldn't carry on. We had quite intensive working capital requirements. So it was very obvious that to carry on funding the business for those newer into the equity would be a bit of a hamster wheel, given the working capital requirements. But I think also very clearly, it became obvious that being a business that turned over 5.5 million in the legal services market at the time, on the backdrop, in the context of the Legal Services Act, external investment, all of those things, meant that it was going to become increasingly tough to compete in that marketplace. So we had to look at some fundamental change, really, to the business to ensure it was sustainable, to allow the exit of those equity partners who are in a cluster sort of coming up to retirement age, and given the competition. And it was fairly clear that we had a highly profitable, very successful business, but that its sustainability was very much dependent on what came next in terms of the structure behind the scenes. So we had to look at that and look at our options and what was available very actively, really.
And presumably that's when there was a change in ownership transaction.
Yeah, and you know, when we looked at numerous options, and at the time I'd known Andrew Holroyd, who was the then CEO of Jackson Cantor for years, sort of at professional events locally, and I bumped into Andrew and Brian, who just joined the business, and I bumped into them in London, actually, at the Modern Law conference, and they were talking about what they were going to do with the business. The Hillsborough inquest was coming to an end. That had been a phenomenal piece of work, you know, very, very difficult. But Elkin Abramson had represented Anne Williams for years on a pro bono basis. She'd brought 20 other families to him when the inquest was announced. But Hillsborough was going to come to an end, and the underlying business was struggling because it was predominantly legal aid work, which at the time wasn't structured in the right way. They had enormous operational challenges. And Lees was looking to sell, really, because we needed that sustainable future. And a lot of people looked at it. It was interesting when we announced that deal, a lot of people sort of regionally looked at it and said, how does that work? But actually, it was a jigsaw puzzle that came together so well, because we had different work types, different geographies, different cash cycles. Lees had an operating infrastructure that we could reverse in. Brian had come from outside legal and had this incredible approach to sort of openness and transparency and culture and how you communicate and best practice in that regard and how to take the business forward and the ambition for it. So actually it came together perfectly like a jigsaw puzzle that, you know, meant that we kept everybody in jobs, which was really, really fundamental when it, you know, when it happened. We lost two people, I think, which in that size of transaction was huge. But really the combination was a sort of very much a 2 and 2 makes 5.
Yeah.
So
And it's all that created the Jackson Lees group.
It did, very, very creatively renamed Jackson Lees.
Branding there, of course, clearly had taken some time.
It did, but it, you know, I think, you know, we laugh about it, but we called it Jackson Lees. We kept Brodie Jackson Kantor as a trading style, as a brand in the access to justice world. And actually, again, that sort of has informed what we do at MAP now, because actually we're strong believers that locally, within the communities, with clients, legal brands as accountancy brands do have massive brand equity. You hear schools of thought to the contrary, but actually, you know, for us that was really important. Lees had a really solid reputation on the Wirral, Brodie Jackson Kantor in the sphere of access to justice, social justice, legal aid is really, really strong. So we had to find a solution which, whilst it wasn't particularly creative, worked for our clients, and that was what was really important. And for the people, you know, you cut people in half, they have the brand, they have the loyalty. It's really important, and people feel very strongly about that. So, you know, we didn't want to sort of shake that up. There was no need to.
Well, that's right. And, you know, I think celebrating the two businesses, acknowledging they are coming together as one for the greater good is the right thing to do, right?
So, absolutely.
You know, even though from a creative perspective, as you say, we might laugh, the reality is it was the perfect name for the coming together of two great businesses, wasn't it?
Absolutely.
And of course, that meant you met for the first time and started doing business with, for the first time, Brian, who is now your co-founder or MAP.
Yeah.
So just talk to me about how you went from Jackson Lees to MAP, or Now Business.
So in essence, as I say, 2016... that happened. The businesses came together. It was very much an acquisition by Jackson Kantor of Lees, rebranded Jackson Lees. When Brian had joined the business in 2014, he'd had a sort of double remit, one to make the business sustainable beyond Hillsborough ending, hence sort of doing the acquisition of Lees. And secondly, to find a capital event for the then owners within a 5-year period. And the three owners, Andrew, Chris and Elkin, were brilliant with us. They gave us carte blanche to run the business. They were still in the business, but we very much ran the business. And when it came to looking at that capital event, I suppose, we had had carte blanche to run the business. We loved it. We were passionate about it. The journey we were creating for our people, the culture was all amazing. We didn't want to sell that to anybody else. And we were also very passionate about the Making a Positive Difference piece, about the social justice work that we did, that actually not just altruistic, it's very commercially viable as well. And it's very cash generative. So that's very helpful to some of the longer tail work that we do that's more profitable, but less cash generative. So creates a good balance. Brian's way of asking me if I was interested was to send me a link on LinkedIn one evening to an MBO seminar. subtle as ever, but And I think we just thought, you know what, this could really work. So we were keen on the sustainability of the business. But at that point, we'd had a few knockbacks from the bank on. We'd seen acquisitions we wanted to do and we couldn't structure them. And it was really frustrating because there were some great deals that we lost out on. So we wanted to find a way to be able to pursue a buy and build strategy whilst keeping Jackson Lees Group very sustainable. And to do that, we needed to find a way for the then owners to exit effectively, and all three of them are still with the business. So again, that's part of our culture and what we do, but to find that capital event and allow to move forward to the next chapter. So I think coming back to the point about brand and brand equity, we very much decided we wanted to pursue a buy and build, but you know, Jackson Lees Group doesn't mean anything in London or the Northeast or the Southwest. So we decided to set up a parent, and when we looked at what that should be and what our approach to market would be, we very much saw the importance of retaining brand equity, so keeping the businesses we acquire as standalone businesses. But what we felt was our single biggest differentiator was that sense of purpose, that driven by purpose rather than just by making money. And we decided, therefore, that what we'd found really effective within Jackson Lees Group was the single value of making a positive difference. So we thought that's what we'll call MAT, making a positive difference. We like the concept of the infinite game, of the infinite journey. You know, we're in it for chapters, milestones along the way, but there isn't an end point. So sort of the MAT acronym played well into that as well, into that journey concept. So we decided to call it MAT on the basis that we were very keen on buying businesses as standalone businesses that did retain their brand locally from a client-facing perspective, but that are powered and fueled by a value proposition. Therefore, they're powered by MAT, which is both their ethos and what we can do to facilitate back office operational efficiency and functions and realise the synergies there in the background and facilitate growth.
And the sort of change in ownership event which occurred, yep, which of course allowed you and Brian to buy 100% of the, yep, business. How was that funded?
So that was funded via Shard Credit Partners, who provided us with a unitranche debt facility to go out and do acquisitions with spectacularly good timing. We completed on the 11th of March, so a whole 10 days or so before the first lockdown. So I have to say that, you know, the initial buy and build strategy was put on hold. Fair to say, most businesses sort of closed their doors, focused on Siebel's furlough, getting people working from home, which taught us to be very agile and dynamic, I would say. Shard were incredibly supportive. I remember Alistair, the CEO, you know, emailing us and saying, what do you need? Which was just amazing in terms of the approach and the support we felt. And it was fairly slow off the ground, but obviously then accelerated massively over the last 18 months.
Indeed. And obviously, as your retained corporate finance advisor, I know very well what the group's acquisition strategy has been and is, and indeed the acquisitions you've made. So I think the only question I'd love to ask is, so, you know, if you now acknowledge that, can you believe, gosh, you know, we're sort of 3 years on from COVID, where is the group now? And perhaps we can just talk briefly about why you've made the acquisitions you have, just for the benefit of our viewers.
Yeah. So I guess to contextualise, when on the 11th of March we completed the refinance and the acquisition of Jackson Lees Group via MBO, we were a 12 million turnover business with a 1.2 million EBITDA. We are now 36 million turnover, about 6.8 million pro forma LTM EBITDA. So huge growth. Really, we have over 500 people, over 14 offices.
Wow. So you've been busy. I think it's
indeed
a succinct summary as to what the last 3 years have had in the store. And did you know in March 2020 that you would end up 3 years on being a co-founder, COO of a business of that magnitude?
Oh, yes and no. Did we have plans, projections and everything else? Yes. Has it happened in the way that we thought? Absolutely not. I think if we rewind back then, we probably thought that we'd do a sort of 5 million turnover acquisition each year for 5 years. It's been very different to that in reality, and that's been largely, I suppose, dictated by market conditions, but also by, I suppose, the flexibility and the agility that we've had in our approach. So as I say, you know, when COVID hit almost immediately, we did have to completely change our approach and regroup a little bit. And, you know, we've, our most recent acquisition of Vividity IP Group, patent attorneys, is something that we never necessarily had in the script back in 2020. But I think we've been very open to opportunities that align. As you know, our key driver is always the cultural fit, which is crucial for us for any acquisition, making sure that people are aligned to the MAT sense of purpose. And then we have very clear ideas around what we want to acquire in terms of service lines, in terms of geographies, in terms of scale. But we've been very open, I suppose, to opportunities along the way and very open-minded about that, which, again, you know, for us, strategy, a business plan once written is out of date, isn't it? So it's about that agility to keep looking, to be open-minded to opportunities, to not close doors too quickly on anything and to consider what comes across our table without getting too distracted and striking that balance.
Yeah, and it's tough, isn't it? I mean, obviously, the exponential growth that has been achieved within maps is just astonishing. And, you know, for sure, is something that deserves huge acclaim and celebration. I've got to ask, why? Because, you know, I know how hard you work. Yeah. I know you've got a family and your family's really important.
Yeah.
I know you've got lots of other interests outside of maps. Why? I mean, surely there's an easier way to exist, Joanne.
I guess so, but we are who we are, aren't we? I think if you look at Brian and me, we kind of, not that we get bored, well, yeah, we get bored quite easily, but also we just, you know, life is the sum of our experiences, isn't it? I suppose we want to get old and look back and think, we did this, we did that, we were open to opportunities, we went, it's a bit of a roller coaster, that's for sure. And I think, you know, the growth we've achieved with debt fund backing as opposed to equity backing is what we're most proud of in many ways, because it does change dynamics and it, you know, it can be quite tough. But for us, I think organic growth is great, but equally for us, I suppose what's key is, you know, and you will hear Brian say that the mapped business has changed him really positively. I think for us, we're such strong believers in making a positive difference within society generally, and we strongly believe that law done in a different way, in a way that looks after the client, that looks after the vulnerable individual, that helps, and, you know, that's crucial to the way we look after our people as well and the experience we create for our people while they're within mapped businesses. Our big, hairy, audacious goal isn't to be X or Y EBITDA or turnover. It's to get MAP listed as a verb in the dictionary. That's what gets us out of bed in the morning. You know, I made a positive difference to my next door neighbour because she's elderly of limited mobility and I put her bins out. It's what really matters to us. So I suppose, you know, when you see some of the good work that we're doing right now, the COVID inquiry is happening in London. We represent the COVID Bereaved Families Group. These are people who had no one through lockdown. They had no one. They were losing people close to them and they had nowhere to turn. And if we can even play a small part in giving them some safety or some sense of control or making sure they have a voice, which is what we're doing now, that just makes the world a better place for us, I think. And, you know, some of our clients who are victims of domestic abuse or asylum seekers who've been to hell on them back, it's just being able to make that difference to them. And as I say, you know, it commercially it works too, so everybody wins. So for us, that's, you know, we don't want to stop there, we want to carry on. So I suppose in answer to your question, why do we do it? Because we love it, because we think that going to work should be fun. It should never, I always think if work feels like a job, it's not good. Work should just feel like fun and that you want to do it, and even on the most difficult days you're in it together, you're a strong team, you want to get through it, and you know you're challenging yourself by finding the solutions to those problems. That's just what makes us tick, I guess, and helping people every day is what gets us out of bed. So yeah.
It's really inspiring because a lot of the things that you say are just second nature to you, but of course to many it wouldn't perhaps be. And yeah, what was really interesting there, John, was to hear you refer to the fact that you love the business because of the great it delivers for the people and stakeholders that the business comes into contact with. And it goes back to where you started, i.e., you know, as a young person, you know, you were very empathetic, you know, very caring, always thinking about others. And actually, even now, as CEO or co-founder of a large legal services business, those traits shine through, right?
I would hope so. I mean, you know, I think the biggest challenge we have now is that when you have over 500 people, you can't know everybody. And we actually really struggle with that.
Yeah.
We're in the middle at the moment of doing our mapped catch-ups, and we get on the road and we go and visit every single office. And somebody said to us last week, you know, wouldn't it be easier to do that by Teams? Absolutely not for us, because unless we take the time to talk to people, to hopefully make them feel valued simply through going out to see them, to explain what we do, where we're at, it's just not worth it, is it? I mean, it's, for us, that's what's crucial in a business. And we hate not knowing what's going on in everybody's lives in a good way, in terms of, you know, how we can help and support people. And it's key to us. You know, we did a talk a few weeks ago about neurodiversity because we Brian and I both have neurodivergent children, and the relief you see in people, in our people, when you talk about things that they have a challenge with too, and they feel quite lonely with that challenge, and just normalizing it. You know, when I went through the cancer experience in 2016, 2017, just normalizing the fact that as a leader in an organization, you have the same challenges as other people, and that just because you're a leader in the business doesn't make those life events go away, is really important. And allowing people to be themselves means that people thrive as well and can be happier for it, hopefully.
No, I mean, it is genuinely really fascinating to hear the way you speak about the things that drive you. And I'm sure our viewers will be very humbled and very inspired by hearing some of the things you're saying. And I wouldn't have mentioned it, but you did. So if you don't mind, I'm just going to ask a question as a consequence. Obviously, you mentioned that in 2016, you know, you have some tough news from a health perspective. And I think, you know, when your health is on the line, it is really easy, isn't it, to very quickly appreciate what's important. Because there is a chance at that time that your time is short.
Yes.
Just talk to me about how, despite having that the very challenging time, you were still able to come out of the other side as a very empathetic, caring, motivated person, because many people would have thrown their towel.
Yeah, I think, being diagnosed with cancer at 39 wasn't necessarily the 40th birthday present that I'd wished for, but I had huge family support. They were utterly phenomenal. I had huge support at work. I mean, we were less than 6 months into Jackson Cancer having acquired Lees, and you know, the support I had at work was huge, and actually work in some ways was my therapy a little bit. I think, you know, it kept me going. I've never been one to sit and watch daytime TV, so the thought of that was unbearable. So actually cracking on with emails was a way to get me through it. It does give perspective at the same time. I would say that everybody sweats the small stuff. And, you know, you hear a lot of people come out of cancer or sort of life-threatening illnesses saying it does give perspective, and it absolutely does. I would say I still sweat the small stuff. I don't think that goes away, because that's just life. We all get bothered by the little things that actually don't matter, but that is just life and natural emotional state and everything else. I suppose what it did was made me focus less far ahead. So I really struggle with, which again plays quite well into not having five-year plans or whatever else, because for me, if I'm alive tomorrow, next week, next year, I feel really privileged by that now. So to a degree, I struggle, you know, when an IFA says, what age do you want to retire? And I'm like, I don't know. If I'm here next year, that'll be great. So to a degree, I think the perspective is more about the dynamism of living in the moment and looking, you know, planning a little bit ahead, but equally being open-minded and flexible in thought processes and stuff. It's probably that was the big learn. And I think, you know, what I took most of all from that experience was the need as a leader. And everyone reacts differently, so I'm not saying this is the way people should react, because I think it's an innately personal thing, how you react to something like that. But for me, I felt a strong need to sort of talk very openly, again, to break stigma a little bit around cancer, to normalize people's experience, back to the whole bring your whole self to work, to say to people it's okay to fall apart and be upset or to struggle, and all of those things are okay. That, you know, obviously cancer is a physical illness, but the impact on your mental health is fairly profound. And I think it's really important to acknowledge that, and that our people see that and see a bit of an emotional journey with it as well. So I think I took a lot of good out from it. I think, you know, talking about, I have a son and a daughter, but, you know, for them seeing sort of physically, obviously when you have something, I had breast cancer, so it's something that is quite a physical challenge, but sort of, I'm really big on that now, particularly with young girls and social media, and the pressure on young girls, I think, is terrifying today. It's something we didn't have as children, and that's really important, and getting that through and actually that you're a person, not just a body, again, is really important to young people. So I try and channel that a little bit in terms of the positives from it. And as I say, it's just part of life, isn't it? You know, we don't talk about work-life balance. We talk about life, because work's part of life. Life's part of work. The two sort of intermingle constantly. So it's just all part of our, again, our NAPT ethos about the approach we take to business, I suppose.
And obviously you mentioned that, you know, cancer is physically, but perhaps as much, if not more so, mentally challenging. I mean, how did you deal with the knowledge that you had cancer?
Mm.
You had two children. You were also running a business and lots of expectation. I mean, that feels quite overwhelming. Certainly from someone's perspective who hasn't been in that position.
Yeah.
How did you actually cope with that?
I think if I look back, I suppose with hindsight, at the time, I probably just went into fairly automated mode. So it was almost like, if I look back, I was there, but not there. I was probably in profound shock.
Mm.
And my primary concern was the children. You know, at the time, Joseph was 4. Mm. And Ads, my daughter, was 6. So they were at an age where that was a major concern, how we communicated that to them and constructively and well, and helped them get through that and move through it. And there isn't, you know, with children, there's always a balance of sharing but not oversharing. And do you know what? One of the things that I remember the most at the time was my Macmillaner saying, when are we telling the children? It wasn't if, it was when. It was taken for read that they would be in the loop. But one of the things she said to me, again, about that whole emotional thing, was it's really important that the children see you cry, because if you shield them from that, they will grow up thinking that they have to be stoic and hide emotion through adversity, and that's not normal. And emotion that's pent up and not released in whatever form that takes is really dangerous. So that was quite a learn, and I think I've applied that since professionally as well, because I think, again, it's really important that, you know, generationally, I suppose, if you rewind 50 years or so, the post-war generation very much felt that need to be stoic and everything else. But actually, is it the best for, are we teaching our children, if we hide all of that from them, to grow up and putting a pressure on them, which, given the external pressures with social media and everything else going on in the world, is just too much for them? I think it probably actually is. So that fine balance is hard to strike, but really important. So yeah, I think I just went through the motions for a while. I just cracked on, carried on. I think that probably was not, with hindsight, the best thing to do, because I think it probably, didn't realize it at the time, but took me a lot longer to get over myself in terms of my sort of ability to cope with stress and everything else. And I followed adjuvant therapy afterwards, which is essentially medication, which was absolutely diabolical, because it is sort of the hormonal impact of that is huge. But you know, I think if you're surrounded by family and friends who care, and colleagues who care, they all got me through it. They pulled me along. They accepted the highs and lows, I suppose, that came with that. And that's really important. I think that safety of feeling that you're surrounded by people who care and have you back at work and at home is crucial.
Well, I mean, as you say, in that situation, all you can do is deal with the terrible cards that you're dealt with. And it sounds like, you know, you played them in a very honest, open, very candid fashion. How was it, though, when you did have to sit down and talk to the children? Because as a dad, you know, I can't imagine me having that conversation without becoming really emotional really quickly. I mean, how did you actually approach that?
So I didn't have the first conversation. Matt did, because I didn't feel strong enough to be able to. And it was couched. I mean, you know, Macmillan are amazing. I have to say the NHS were utterly, unbelievably good through that. And they help with messaging and, you know, age dependent for children. You know, there are books, like, and cartoons that explain that mummy has a lump, and explain about it and everything else that are really well written. And I think we were just open. We were just really open. And, you know, there's some quite funny stories afterwards that I'll tell you offline probably. But the children came out with, you know, and you just go with it. You just go with it as best you can as a parent. I think, you know, there's no manual for parenting, is there? You learn as you go along. So you have to just do your best in the moment in terms of the way you deal with things and the honesty of the conversation pitched to the age and the sort of understanding level of your child or your children. And you do that to the best of your ability, I guess. And that's what we had to do. I think, you know, there's no easy way. And I think I look at my youngest now, he has enormous health anxiety, which from research I've done and things is, you know, the age he was at the time is probably a critical age where trauma stays. Age 4 is a critical sort of age in a child's development, as I understand it, which means that things do sort of carry on. And he has quite bad health anxiety as a result of that, which, you know, is very unfortunate, but is what it is. And we just have to help him with that. But yeah, you just, you know, I was incredibly, incredibly lucky, really lucky. I think, you know, many people aren't. And, you know, I have colleagues and friends who haven't been as fortunate as I was. And at the end of that's why sort of my motto is very much live for today, live for the moment and, you know, make the most.
Situations that brings that home, right? Because we're all on borrowed time, fundamentally. And I think appreciating and being grateful for the time you've got is what's important.
It's huge. And I think, you know, you do develop a gratitude for the smaller things, you know, for being able to see a sunrise or leaves on trees and flowers bloom in the spring and all of those things. So, yeah, you know, it's, again, I think for me that just about being kind to people, being compassionate, you know, not regretting stuff, learning from mistakes, just being human. Really important, isn't it?
It is. But interestingly, in business, for one reason or another, a lot of people actually choose not to allow those traits and characteristics to come through, which is fascinating, isn't it?
It is. I think that's changing. And I think, you know, everybody's different. And what we always say is, if, you know, if you're not comfortable sharing, that's okay too. I think it's important that people, we try and encourage people to bring themselves to work, whatever themselves looks like. So, you know, if you're not comfortable sharing, that's fine. If you want to share, that's fine too, within parameters, obviously. But, you know, it's about being yourself. And
yes,
I think it's not wearing the mask that's important. It's not feeling like you have to work with a mask on. For me, is what's most important, that you can be your true self.
And obviously, despite the hurdles you've had to grapple with, and some of the setbacks, if we call them that, likewise, you know, you sit here today, you know, as a very focused, incredibly motivated CEO and co-founder of Matt. What's next for Matt? Because clearly you've kindly talked about where the group has gotten to, but what's perhaps in store?
Oh, gosh. So loads. We have an inorganic growth strategy around continuing to acquire the right businesses. We have an organic growth strategy, which is around ensuring commercial success and prosperity for everybody. I think, as I say, our BHAG of getting Matt listed as a verb in the dictionary is something we'd really love to pursue. We're very focused on neurodiversity in terms of the need to create genuinely inclusive environments and allow people to thrive. That's really key to us, you know, the breadth and the wealth of voices around the table and different creative thought processes and different voices is really important. So, yeah, I mean, in terms of milestones, we're looking at refinance and how we take that to the next stage to facilitate more acquisitions. We'll look to acquire the right businesses. We, as you know, we've got a very strong pipeline. So it's about doing things in the right way, taking our time, marrying the organic growth, the inorganic growth. You know, at some point in the future, it'll be time for the next chapter and for Brian and I to get off the rocket, but we're nowhere close to that yet.
The moon is still at...
It is going like this all over the place on the way. But yeah, you know, it feels like we've got so much to do and we're certainly not bored, that's for sure. And yeah, I think carrying on, embedding what we're doing, growing the business, looking at, you know, how we can make a positive difference to more clients, to more communities, is which we love it, and it's what we want to carry on doing. So long may it continue.
Yeah, well, incredibly exciting. And you specifically talk there about continuing to make acquisitions that are strategically of relevance to the group. Lots of our viewers perhaps will be anticipating making their first acquisition, or perhaps are going through a potential acquisition now.
Yeah.
I mean, any insights, Joanna, as far as things that are incredibly important to get right when you are acquiring a business? I appreciate the answer is lots, but any sort of immediate learnings you'd like to share with someone who might be going through their first ever acquisition?
Definitely. So I'd say the first thing, always go with your gut instinct. If something feels wrong, it invariably is wrong. So go with what feels right. I think what we've really learned is that that cultural alignment is absolutely crucial. And if that's not there fundamentally, you're in for challenges down the line. I think having the right advisors on board is fundamental. Going through a comprehensive DD process and commercial DD, I think the biggest thing we've learned is always to talk to as many people as you can within the business. It's very tempting just to talk to the sellers, but getting to know the wider team in the right way, that can be tricky and causes, you know, challenges and everything else. But I think, it, you know, particularly in, depends on the type of business, of course, but in professional services, in people businesses, particularly, you're the sum of your people, and that's it. Without your people, you're nothing. So getting to know the team and putting them at ease and them understanding what's coming next is really important. And I think, you know, we've had big learns along the way with that. Get talk to as many people as you can in advance of a transaction, because a transaction's a point in time. Life after the transaction and the focus on the growth and the collective collaborative team that is there afterwards is really important. So they're the key things for me, the culture, the cultural alignment, getting the DD and the advisors right, and then getting to know the team as much as possible.
Thanks, Joanna. I could sit and talk to you literally all day, actually. however, sadly, time is probably running short on us. So I've just got one final question I'd really love to get your input and take on, please, Joanna. So obviously, as someone who has achieved so much in your career so far, do you ever sort of sit down, stop, and celebrate achievement? Or do you feel like you have so much more to achieve and therefore actually you haven't arrived yet?
I think that's where the cancer experience did change me, actually, that I kind of feel now if everything had to stop tomorrow, I feel like it's good enough. Do I feel I've got loads more to give, loads more I want to see, loads more I want to learn? 100% yes. So yeah, I still feel like there's a way to go. You know, I don't feel anywhere close to, I don't know what I'd do if I stopped now. I just can't imagine it. I think we're in lifelong learning, right? So, you know, whatever we do with MAPT and whatever happens, I want to carry on learning, meeting people, opening my mind to different cultures, different environments and all of those things. So, yeah, just excited about every day that's ahead. Do I celebrate? Hell yeah.
Well, I can confirm you do, for sure. We've done that too many times together.
But yeah, no, do I celebrate? Yes. Brian and I both self-reflect and take stock and think, what could we do better? What could be better? Absolutely, yes. So I think, you know, we'll never be, we just don't believe in an end point. There isn't one. We're just on this journey, making things better as we go. So with no end point.
Where does that sort of, because you've said something numerous times, which I've got to pick up on. Where does the sort of self-critical nature come from? Because a lot of people would just say, Joanna, you're brilliant, you've done very well, but actually that's not good enough for you. You want to always better yourself and of course the business that you are CEO of. So where does that sort of need to self-improvement come from?
I honestly don't know. I think just curiosity about, I just think that if you stand still, life would get really boring without learning and without learning from your mistakes. And, you know, we only learn from our mistakes and what hasn't worked and what we can do better. And I just feel this constant need to keep going and keep moving. And I don't know. I think, I guess my parents worked really, really hard for us to create a world for us that was a better place. You know, when I was at music school on Saturdays at Birmingham, you know, they found ways to pay for that and to allow me to do that. I want the same for my children, and I want my children to live in a world that's a better place. And without getting too philosophical, I guess, until the world is a perfect place, which it will never be, and God knows it's very far from that now, I won't be happy. So quite a lot of work ahead, I would suggest. And if we can do a tiny little bit to make that better, then great. But yeah, until we have a perfect political, economical, environmental world, I won't be happy. So
it sounds like we've got a lot more to do.
Oh, yeah.
Joanna, it really does. Huge thanks again. I found not only this to be incredibly interesting, but genuinely also really inspiring. I mean, it's very rare that I have the pleasure of spending time with a very successful business person who also evidently approaches business in a very ethical, sustainable, fair, sensible way. I think sadly a lot of people think success is only possible if somebody is losing, and evidently you're a really good example of someone whom does business in the right way. So huge thanks for joining me today, Joanna.
Thank you.
It's been a pleasure today to spend some time with Joanna Kingston Davies on our Confessions of a COO podcast. Not only was it inspirational to hear more about how Joanna chose to take positives out of her very horrific cancer experience, but to actually understand how resilience can be built on the back of adversity. MAPT Group is truly making a positive difference, and for sure, I'm not remotely surprised under the stewardship and direction of Joanna and indeed her co-founder, Brian. I am absolutely hugely grateful to Joanna for spending some time with us today on our Confessions of a COO podcast. And for sure, if you've enjoyed this podcast, please do visit all of our social media channels for other similar Confessions of a COO podcasts, which either have been taken historically or will be coming out shortly. But for now, my name is Carl Swansbring. You've been watching Confessions of a COO, and I look forward to seeing you all on a future podcast.